The moon is in its new phase right now, so with no moon in the sky and very clear skies across the region, it should be a great weekend for watching the stars and planets and all the other offerings of the night sky. But you might have a little trouble seeing it depending on where you live. There are individuals and societies devoted to this issue, trying to convince the world that maybe we do not need to burn so many lights outside at night, because all the lights make the dark places where we can see the sky rarer all the time. In August of 2013, we talked to Paul Bogard about this very issue related in his book, The End of Night. Since the interview is pre-recorded again, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Here we go. We make it increasingly harder to see the night sky as it would naturally appear over the Earth because we like our electric lights. We feel safer in areas with lights. And Paul Bogard sums up the situation in the title of his book, The End of Night. Paul Bogard teaches creative writing or creative nonfiction at James Madison University. He's already the editor of an anthology called Let There Be Night, Testimony on Behalf of the Dark. I think I know where Paul Bogard is coming from here. Paul, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
That's good to be here. Thanks.
You start the book, The End of Night, in the least dark place on Earth. Las Vegas is the first up in your introduction. Why there?
Well, a little bit of shock value, I think, and maybe an appropriate starting point, because it's acknowledged as the brightest pixel on the photographs from space. So there are actually many cities around the world that are, on the whole, brighter than Las Vegas, but there's no single pixel, no single spot on the map, if you will, that's brighter than the Strip in Las Vegas and especially the Luxor beam. If folks know, the beam that's shooting straight out of the top of the Luxor is the brightest beam of light in the world. So the book generally follows from starting in very bright places and working my way down to darker places. So Vegas seemed like the best place to start.
Well, true. And in fact, when you follow the book in a sense along the Bortle scale, I'll ask you what that is in a moment, but in terms of super bright to super dark, and it goes 9 to 1. So we get to the really dark places as the book goes on. So who was John Bortle, and how did he develop this scale?
John Bortle is an amateur astronomer from upstate New York who, about a dozen years ago, finally got tired of having mostly younger amateur astronomers invite him out to various places in the Northeast, saying, you have to come out here. It's so dark. And when he would get out to these spots, he recognized that it was dark out there, but it wasn't really so dark. It wasn't as dark as it had been. And he realized that these younger astronomers had never really experienced true natural darkness. And he came up with what we call the Bortle scale. It's a 9-point scale that shows us, it starts with 9, with the brightest places like a Vegas or a Times Square or really any major city in the world, and works its way down to level 1, which is a primitive darkness, a kind of primeval darkness that there's no evidence of artificial light in any direction or even up in the sky. It's a couple things stand out to me about the scale. One is that many folks would say there are no level 1 areas left in the lower 48, that there just is no place you can go to get that kind of darkness anymore. And the other thing, and I think this is particularly important for my book, is that most Americans live most of our lives in levels 5 and above, so 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, and we just rarely or even never experience darkness that's in those lower levels that used to be everyone's experience.
But, Paul, did you experience dark, starry skies growing up, and if so, where?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I grew up in Minneapolis, but the year I was born, my parents and grandparents built a cabin up, as we say here, up north, up on a lake. And so I grew up every summer going up to our cabin on a lake. And when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, the darkness up there would rank on this Bortle scale at least a 3 and maybe a 2. It was just very dark up there. And so I grew up with this firsthand experience of standing out on the dock under the Milky Way and watching the shooting stars and that kind of thing. And it's still very dark up there. I was just up there a couple nights ago watching the Perseids. But it's probably drifting away from the 3, maybe even into the 4 range already. It's just there's even up there 3 hours north of the Twin Cities, it's starting to get to be too much light.
Is there just that much population growth up there, or are the lights just that that bright that the limited population does use?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. There, you know, there aren't a lot of folks living up there, but there are more than there were, you know, 25 or 30 years ago. And primarily, though, we're just using more light. So there's an interesting statistic came out of the UK, actually, that noted that because of efficiency, our lights are much more efficient, but we're just using more of it. So even though we're getting more and more efficient with our lighting fixtures and bulbs and all that kind of thing, we just want more light. So just about everywhere is getting brighter, and almost nowhere is getting darker.
I was thinking about that very confluence of events. The fact is that we do tend to spend less electricity now illuminating areas, but with things like LEDs, we can make the light so much brighter. And I know, for example, my wife bought me a light for photography recently, and it blinds you. You can't stick it in somebody's face. It's like a flash that's on all the time, all LEDs.
Yeah, you know, the LEDs, the light emitting diodes are really... they're really an interesting thing for a lot of different reasons. When I was talking with folks for the book about it, lighting designers and dark sky advocates and those kind of folks, they really are, you know, they're both excited about LEDs, but they're also nervous. And they're excited because LEDs are not electric light, but they're electronic light, essentially. And they are highly programmable. We can program them on computers, so... You know, you can have a parking lot that's lit until midnight, and then the lights could be reduced, or a community could reduce the lights, their street lights. But they also represent great peril, too. We can talk about that more if you'd like.
And we would like. We'll come back to our previous interview with Paul Bogard from August of 2013, talking about his book, The End of Night. We'll come back to the program again because it is pre-recorded. No new phone calls or emails, but back to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Bogard in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening and happy Friday to you. Our guest today is a guest from August of 2013. That's when Paul Bogard joined us to talk about the difficulty of seeing the wonders of the night sky because we have so many lights on. His book is called The End of Night. Because the interview is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. So a moment that took your breath away, Paul, you describe... standing under the night sky in Morocco, was this a one on the Bortle scale?
Yeah, that would have been a one for sure. that was a great experience. I was backpacking when I was 18 after high school and woke up in the middle of the night and stepped out of the youth hostel into what I, at first, as a good Minnesota boy, thought was snow. I thought it was snowing. But, of course, the edge of the Sahara, it's not snowing. It just was starlight unlike I'd ever seen before. And, you know, I know it happened. I can still remember it, but it's like a dream because I've never really seen anything since like that.
Does the, when you're under just starlight, and I don't remember whether there was any moon out that night or not, but is there actually a reflection? I mean, can you see shadows cast by starlight?
You can, actually, which is just remarkable. I mean, that's one of the qualities of, you know, if you get down to the Bortle scale on the one and into the two level, you can see shadows cast by the Milky Way, for example, or even by planets if it's dark enough in the right circumstances. And the other thing, you know, the really magic thing about real natural primitive darkness like that that we're talking about is that as you get into a darker place, it actually gets brighter if you're out under a clear sky with the stars. So you start to see not only the starlight, but the zodiacal lights and the air glow in the atmosphere and all this natural light. And the other thing that happens that's wonderful is that our human eyes are such miraculous organs that they begin to adjust, and we actually can see fairly well in that kind of light. It's pretty remarkable.
So at one time, we must have taken seeing the Milky Way for granted. And you point out, I think the figure is that, was it 80% of children born in America today will never know a night sky dark enough to see the Milky Way?
Exactly. Yeah, it's gone from what was one of the most common human experiences, you know, stepping out your door, wherever that was, and coming face to face with the universe, to now one of the most rare experiences if you're living in any industrialized modern country at this point. Just there are so few, say, Americans in the lower 48 who have this experience of stepping out and seeing the Milky Way. I'm guessing that folks in your part of the world, there may be a higher percentage, just there's some more good darkness out there. But you think about east of the Mississippi, for example, and there are just not a whole lot of folks who are stepping out and coming face to face with the universe.
No, indeed. We can talk more about the parts of the country where this happened. You, coming back to Las Vegas, Chapter 9, which is actually the first chapter of the book, because of the Bortle scale, you left Las Vegas and went searching for darkness in the hinterlands of Nevada. And I'm kind of surprised you were willing to share this information with the Nevada Highway Patrol in your book. What were you doing out there?
Exactly. Yeah, we extended the speed limit a little bit that night, getting from Las Vegas up to Great Basin National Park, up in the northeast, or I guess middle east part of the state, on the border there. You know, I was driving up there, and I had a rental car, and just was cruising along, and just, I had remembered when I was younger, I used to sometimes driving home would turn off the headlights on the car through this one particular golf course that was near my parents' house, and just kind of sail, as I describe it, sail the curving, sloping road for a little while with just my parking lights. And I thought, maybe I'll try that out here in the desert. And it was a phenomenal experience, really. I mean, literally breathtaking experience. I turned the lights back on pretty quickly, but then turned them off again. It was just too cool to not do it again and again. So
do you share the thought that that there are no places at one on the Bortle scale in the lower 48?
Well, you know, I'm hopeful that that's not true. I'm hopeful that there are still some places. You know, the folks that I talk to who have a lot of experience with this are in the National Park night sky team. They actually have a night sky team right now that's going around to all the different Park Service areas and measuring the level of darkness there, because the Park Service is now considering darkness one of the qualities, resources that they're going to try to preserve. And so these guys have been around to so many different places. And Chad Moore, who's the head of the team, told me that he thinks that on any given night there may be places that would register a one depending on the weather and the conditions and that kind of thing. But one of the first things he said to me is, you know, it'd be much easier for you to find that if you hopped on a plane and flew to Australia and went out into the middle of the outback. But I really wanted to think about darkness that was in our daily lives, you know, in the places that we live or the places like the parks that we could get to.
So is the suggestion then that we could potentially recreate some dark areas even within civilization, quote unquote?
We can definitely bring a lot of darkness back, even in the cities and the suburbs and the places that we live. And the neat thing about how we would do that, and we can talk a little bit about that, it primarily would relate to shielding our lights. So that is, instead of having lights that are sending their light all over the straight up into the sky and glaring into our eyes, we would shield those lights so the lights are just directed down to the road or to the sidewalk or to the property that we want lit. And the effect of doing that, say in a city or a large community, is that that city and that community is still going to be lit. You know, it's not going to be in dark, but there's going to be an opposite ripple effect out into the countryside, into the wild areas, and those places will be much darker. We'll bring back those skies in a way that could be quite dramatic.
It sounds like similar conditions to the World War II blackouts that were deliberate blackouts that were designed to just make it very hard for enemy bombers, potential enemy bombers, to see our cities.
Well, it's kind of similar, although I think, you know, one thing I'm always kind of eager to point out to folks is that nobody's talking about not having light. I think we, at this point, we love artificial light. We want it. We want it for safety and security. We want it for just being able to see and move around. What folks are talking about is just using light more intelligently, more thoughtfully, in ways that actually can enhance our safety and security and even bring back some of this darkness.
There are pictures in the book, including some of the satellite imagery that shows what the American landscape looks like at night. You were talking about how east of the Mississippi, probably no particular dark areas there. Is the light growing faster than the population? It's sort of a similar question to the one about northern Minnesota.
Well, it is. The statistics that the numbers folks use is that the population is growing about 1% a year, and the light pollution is growing at about 6% a year. So it's really kind of exponential growth. There's a really interesting map that I show in the book, which comes from what's called the World Atlas of the Artificial Night Sky Brightness, which is put together by a couple of Italian astronomers who wanted to show the true extent of light pollution. So we think that, you know, normally the cities are going to be bright, sure, but once you get out into the country, it's still dark. And what they wanted to show is that yes, it is still dark, but it's not as dark as it was because there's a whole lot of light that's up in the atmosphere that's in that sky taking away the darkness. And so their maps are so dramatically show the true extent. And in fact, east of the Mississippi, they show no natural dark places left.
I do remember the night glow from growing up in the greater New York area on Long Island. There was just, particularly in the wintertime with all the streetlights, there was just sort of a purple glow in the humidity.
Yep.
Most nights. And I think a lot of other cities have similar sorts of purple or orange, or I think you mentioned Boston having a yellow glow.
Yeah, I was visiting with a guy out there, and I went out to Walden Pond, actually, to see where Thoreau had spent his nights, and this guy used to be the president of the Illuminating Engineering Society, so he was a lighting guy, and he said he described the sky over Boston as the great yellow sky.
Right. We're talking to Paul Bogard about his book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light.
You will notice that we do take some phone calls and emails over the course of the program, but they're from the original airing of the program. It is several months old. And so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today, but thank you for listening.
Paul, is there any single worst contributor, like the fact that, for one thing, it seems like nobody ever turns off their advertising signs at night?
You know, there's a real recipe that any city has of the different contributions, whether it be streetlights or parking lots, gas stations, billboards. A couple that I would highlight, I guess, especially are these new electronic billboards that are going in all over the country that typically stay on all night and are constantly kind of changing and flashing, and those are very bright lights. Stadium lighting, if folks are near a university, for example, with intramural fields, stadium lighting is very bright. You know, in a more rural area, though, what I see oftentimes are what we call security lights, and the term is kind of an oxymoron because, as a lot of the folks that I talked to pointed out, these lights tend to be very bright and very glary, so they make it actually harder for us to see if we look at them. They block, they create shadows, and they spread their light all over the place. So if you're driving down a country road, I'm sure out in Oregon, Northern California, they have these security lights. They're just, you can see them from miles away. And there's no reason for you to see them from miles away if they're meant to just light that property. So you throw a shield on that light, the property is lit, you feel good about lighting your property, but it's not sending light straight into the sky or into anybody's eyes anymore.
And these tend to be those greenish mercury vapor lamps, don't they?
super bright, yeah, mercury vapor lights. That's the thing. Yep.
Plus, you get within a few feet of them, they're going,
yeah,
buzzing away at you. Let us take some calls. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Bogard, the author of The End of Night.
Hi, my heart leaps to see Hellbop going across the Mojave Sky. Remember the comet?
Yeah, I do, sure.
Hellbop?
Right.
In the Yucca Valley area.
Mm-hmm. And you got to see that pretty well because you're out in the Mojave Desert.
Oh, my. And, you know, at 40 years old then, I got my second humbling experience to lay on that desert sand and look up. I said, what is that? And my boss said, that's the Milky Way. I go, what is that? Spiral nebula. Could have sworn I saw that. But it was a wonderful experience. And that's when it hit me. We are just little piss ants crawling around here when I looked up. And I had a friend come over one night, and in the morning I saw him walking around outside my camper shell. And he goes, where is she? And they go, she's up on the roof looking up at the sky and fell asleep. It's so magnificent.
It really is. Thanks for the call, Jeannie. Appreciate that. Paul, I assume you're old enough to have seen some of the comets that have appeared within the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years.
Yep.
Did you get a chance to see those out in fairly remote places where they were just that much more interesting to see?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't. I remember seeing, I think, was it Hale-Bopp back in the early 90s?
Yeah, I believe that was the one.
I was living in Albuquerque, and this was kind of before I had really started writing about this subject. And I remember, you know, kind of trying to drive out of the city a little ways to see it better, but not really even being cognizant of how much better it would be if we had just gone, you know, gotten out to a really dark place. We thought, well, we'll just drive to the edge of the city, and that'll be dark. So I saw it, but I don't think I really saw it in all its glory.
Well, you know, Jeannie said, though, about the dust and some of the stuff up there. I did not realize that at the time when our forefathers could see the sky much better than we could, that constellations were not just, in all cases, the stars, but in some cases, some of the other interstellar stuff up there that makes up the universe.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things that we just, you know, as modern Americans can't, we have a real hard time even imagining what people are talking about when they say that. But if you imagine nights dark enough and a sky bright enough that you not only are making shapes out of the stars, but shapes out of the places where you look up and interstellar dust or gas is blocking the stars and creating shapes, and you're imagining things there. That's how dark and vivid the sky was. I wanted to, if I could, go back to a couple things that your caller mentioned.
Okay, sure.
I thought it was a wonderful call because I think, and I don't want to guess at her age at all, but I'm thinking that one thing I hear again and again is that folks who are maybe 50 and older will say to me, I have this memory of this wonderful night. And folks who are maybe younger than that, or younger than 40, let's say, very seldom come up to me and say, I have a memory of this. And so we're really raising generations of younger Americans who are not experiencing these kind of wonderful things, and then probably aren't going to care that much that, you know, folks like me are saying we're losing this. And I think she spoke to what is one of the most important, I think, experiences of coming face-to-face with the universe, which is the sense of humility, the sense of staring out into the universe and realizing that there are hundreds of billions of stars out there and even hundreds of billions of galaxies beyond that. And it really makes you feel both small, but I think also very large in the sense of realizing that here is our place. This is Earth. This is, we have to take care of it. There's no other place to go, right? You know, I think when we lose that vision, we lose that real humbling philosophical experience.
There really is a sense of scale. I remember this, some moments like that in my teens in Connecticut, where there's a little more sky than there is in greater New York, and realizing, wow, there's a lot of stuff out there.
Exactly.
And we're very small.
Yep.
Let's go to John and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Bogard. His book is The End of Night.
Hi, a comment and a question. At Odell Lake, I was walking out on a dark night to my van, this winter, and I couldn't see it. I sensed it before I got to it. It was like I was in a cave. But my question is, in the Willamette Valley or the coastal areas where there's more moisture and stuff in the sky, did our forefathers not see things as well? I mean, it's just hazier here, even if there are no lights. Is that part of why I don't see things in the valley?
Excellent question. Thanks for that, John.
It makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not an astronomer, so I can't speak to it specifically, but I do know that, you know, if in places like where I am right now, which is Minnesota, I was just talking about this with somebody last night, there's so much humidity in the air that that's really going to affect our ability to see, especially things close to the horizon. One of the, you know, most amazing experiences that we don't have very often anymore is seeing stars come all the way down to the horizon and fall off the edge of the world, as it were, you know. And I think that maybe when you're out in the valley out there or out by the ocean, when you get that kind of moisture in the air, maybe even back in the good old days, wasn't happening too. I'm not sure.
That haze, though, that John talks about, yeah, I could see how that would certainly create some issues. We'll take a break here and come back and talk more with Paul Bogard about the end of night, searching for natural darkness in an age of artificial light. And this is a previously recorded segment for the program. We'll come back and you'll hear more of Paul Bogard. Just a reminder that this is a pre-recorded interview, therefore no new phone calls or emails today. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about the end of night in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're stepping back in time just a bit today. Paul Bogard joined us in August of 2013 to talk about The End of Night, his book about how difficult it is to see the night sky around much of the world. There are calls from the original program, but we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Here is Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Bogard.
Yes, thank you. In my youth, I went in the Lake of the Woods area of Minnesota and southern Ontario, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty dark there. Whether it still is or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Also, Isle Royale, the national park that's the eye of the wolf's head of Lake Superior, is quite excellent place for darkness. Mm-hmm. But in more recent years, I lived in eastern Connecticut, and from 26 miles away, you could see the glow in the sky from Providence, Rhode Island, much better than you could the stars above.
Right. Yeah, the cities have quite a glow to them. And thanks for sharing those stories with us, Mark. And that's a pretty much a constant, isn't it, Paul?
Yes, it really is. And I think, you know, we're talking about, again, I'm hearing, you know, from maybe older folks who have these experiences and about remote areas as well. But even in these remote areas, we're starting to, you know, we have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in the northern part of the state here. And even in this very dark place now, a friend just told me they could see the light on the horizon from a new casino that just went in on a reservation near Duluth. So,
oh, wow. So let's talk to Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking The End of Night with Paul Bogard.
Hi. Well, I also think that all these brightly lit city nights make people kind of human-centric. You know, you feel like you're in a world created for and by humans only. Yeah. But I had a comment. I wrote a letter once as the Starlight City Nights Project, because it really irks me when I go into a city and there's all these lights in these office buildings that there's nobody in them. It's a huge amount of waste of energy and, you know, trying to lower our carbon footprint and create less pollution. So has anybody done the numbers on how much energy is wasted in lights being lit up when nobody's using them? And then I also thought of an idea of having motion detector streetlights at, like, after 2 a.m. when the bars all close or something like that, because it just seems incredibly wasteful, as well as, you know, blocking out our natural natural light sky at night. So,
all right, good questions.
I'll listen on the radio.
All right, thanks, Pam. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a great call, and so many things to touch on. I think maybe the first thing I would say is she touches on the fact that what I love about this issue is that it's something we can so readily do something about. It doesn't have to be the way it is now. We're using light, way more light than we need, in ways that really don't help us, and we can attack those things and do a better job of using light while maintaining a level of safety and security and that kind of thing. And so she mentioned figures about waste of energy and that kind of thing. The International Dark Sky Organization, which is a wonderful resource for folks if they're interested, at darksky.org, they list about a $2 billion waste of energy in the lower 48 every year just from the outdoor lights. So that's not talking about what she was saying, the buildings with the interior lights. You add those interior lights in, that figure goes much higher. And if you then start to add in some of the costs that we haven't talked too much about, which include human health costs or ecological costs of all this light, the actual cost of all this light is really not properly represented by the cost of electricity, which is so cheap. It's much more accurately represented by a very large number that's getting larger all the time, the true cost of all this light.
Let us take another call. Here's Karen in Port Orford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Bogard. His book is The End of Night.
Hi. My name is Karen, and I'm in the coastal town of Port Orford. Mm. We have adopted an ordinance that we support dark skies, and we have reflectors on all of our outdoor lights to direct the light down so that we can see the sky.
Excellent. And how long has that been in effect, Karen?
About a year now. Mm-hmm. Just about everybody's on board with it, and it's made a huge difference. And actually, it's given us more of a safety factor, because by directing the light down, we actually get more light.
All right. Interesting concept there, and I want to get into that further with Paul. Thank you for the call, Karen. The idea, though, that light, if you direct the light downward, you actually see better. Can you explain the whole glare concept? There's a pretty good pair of pictures in the book that illustrates this really well.
Yeah, absolutely. So glare, as folks would know, is that bright light that's shining right into your eyes, and that is, by definition, blinding you. It's making it harder for you to see. And so many of our lights at night, I was talking earlier about security lights do this, but also many of our street lights, lights in parking lots and that kind of thing, are glaring right into your eyes. It's making it harder for you to see. So I don't think that adds to our safety. And what folks are talking about, like your caller just said, is not turning the lights off. We're not saying no light. Again, we're talking about just shielding the light so that when you look at the actual fixture, you don't see the bulb. What you see is the light that's coming down from the bulb that's lighting the area that you want to see, but it's not blinding you. So it's also keeping the light from shining straight into the sky and taking away our view of the stars. And it's helpful in so many ways. And I think she talked about a citywide ordinance. I think when people start to think about the way we use light and realize how important darkness is for so many reasons, it becomes this win-win-win situation that we can so readily take action on this issue and benefit from doing so in so many ways.
I know that I think it was the IDA, the International Dark Sky Association, that came up with the idea of light trespass. Have you heard of other communities like Port Orford that are making moves to put ordinances in place to preserve night sky?
Absolutely. All over the country, really. And you mentioned the IDA, the International Dark Sky Association. They teamed up a couple of years ago with the Illuminating Engineering Society, so the lighting guys, the lighting engineers, to come up with what they call model lighting ordinances that communities of any size can adopt, that give us a better sense of how much light do we need, how much light is good for these different situations. The other thing I would point to is, you know, I can imagine people saying, oh, well, you know, that's some little town on the coast, you know, it can do it. We can't really do it where we live. I would actually say, if you look at a couple cities in Arizona, Flagstaff and Tucson, that have much lower levels of lighting for some of these reasons, you can also look at the entire country of France, including the City of Light, Paris. that have just this July put into place new lighting laws designed to cut carbon emissions, to save energy, and, as they say, to recognize the importance of the nocturnal environment, that this is darkness is an important resource for us. So an entire country is starting to take action on these issues.
And for the folks who are concerned about crime, you do get into the book, into the subject matter of, well, gee, I mean, how much worse does the crime get when you turn the lights down? And the answer is?
Really not much worse at all. In fact, there are stories, and people can Google these stories, of towns all across the U.K. and even in the States where communities have turned off the lights to save money, usually, and there's been no rise in crime. The police report no rise in crime, you know, as though the minute we turn off our lights, we're gonna, you know, these areas are going to be swamped with criminals. I think what I would say about this issue of safety and security, lighting and darkness, is that it's a complex issue, and we too often reduce it to the simple equation of
because, on or off.
Yeah, some light will help us be safer. That means more light will make us more safer, and it just doesn't work that way.
Let's take some more calls. We have Dell in Eureka, California, on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Bogard. His book is The End of Night.
Well, hello. I grew up in Shasta County in a rural area of Shasta County, and I always saw the stars. And I now live in Eureka, and I never see the stars because it's always foggy over here, and I miss it terribly. Mm. And I'm afraid my grandchildren don't know what stars are, really.
Yep.
And I find that parking lots have these very, very high standards to put their lights on, and I feel they should lower their standards and always point the light to the floor, and it doesn't need to take that many standards then and that many lights.
All right. Good question. Good points to bring up, Dell, and I hope you get a chance to see the sky again soon. So when we're talking about changing the lighting and directing it downward, are we also talking about reducing intensity? Are we talking about reducing height, as Dell was just talking about?
Mm. Yeah, both of those things. I mean, in terms of the parking lots, as she mentioned, a couple things we can do. Like one of the biggest offenders in probably any American community are the car dealerships, where they have their lots all brightly lit all through the night, kind of thing. And so if you go to a town like Flagstaff, where they have a dark sky ordinance, what the dealerships there do is they have the bright lights when they're open for business. When they close for business, those bright lights go off, and lower yellow lights come on that are about 10 or 12 feet above that light the cars for, again, the safety and security issue, but they're not sending so much light into the sky. So that's a practical way to do it with the parking lots.
I want to come back and talk about Paris, because this is a really interesting example. Who is François Jussen, and what did he do to the city's lights? It sounds like it's almost like stage lighting.
Yeah, exactly. Great point. François Jussen is, until just a couple of years ago, was the man in charge of relighting Paris. And he spent the last 30 years essentially relighting all the monuments, all the bridges, all the famous buildings. And what Paris is such a wonderful subject, because light is so important to them. They know, they recognize that it's one of the reasons people come to the city, and they spend hundreds of thousands of euros every year creating this atmosphere with their lighting. And it's given rise to some really unique ways to use light. Light is so beautiful there, but they've also committed themselves to cutting their energy use by 30% by the year 2020 while still doing this. And they're totally confident they can do it by using some of the things we've talked about already.
Let's take another call. We have Al and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My experience with the night sky was in the empty court in Saudi Arabia. I was doing some geophysical survey there. And truly, at night, it's like a dome covered with crystals. It's just amazing. It's almost like a life coming to you. I have also a question. Is there any health effect from being exposed to light most of the time?
Well, that you do get into that a bit. Thanks for the call, Alan. And the book does get into that, particularly with as it corresponds to night workers. But just on a general sense, is there effects of light on the human body, artificial light?
Yeah, there seem to be real effects. And, you know, the science on this is new, but it's building all the time. And basically the bottom line is that humans, like all life on Earth, evolved in bright days and dark nights, and we haven't had any time to evolve to adjust to all this bright light at night. And it seems to be affecting us in three primary ways. The first is that it's disrupting our sleep and contributing to sleep disorders, which are tied to every major disease we're dealing with. It's confusing our circadian rhythms, those internal rhythms that keep everything, you know, ticking along healthy inside of us. And then it's also impeding the production of the hormone melatonin, which is only produced in darkness. And this lack of melatonin in our blood now is being linked to the development of breast cancer and prostate cancer, so much so that the World Health Organization now is listing night shift work as a probable carcinogen.
Really?
Yeah.
So you actually can get more, you're more likely to get cancer if you work the night shift.
Exactly. That's what they seem to be finding. And again, it's what they found so far is with, they first studied nurses, emergency room nurses who were up all night, a higher incidence of breast cancer, and now they're finding in men a higher incidence of prostate cancer.
And there's something else here about the way we sleep, which has changed, because you're not the first book. There have been quite a few references to this in recent years, though, but the fact that we used to sleep differently. We would sleep and be out for a couple of hours, usually when it got dark, but then we would wake up in the middle of the night.
Exactly, yeah. This idea of first sleep and second sleep and kind of a period of in between where we, you know, did all sorts of different things. But, you know, it just that speaks to how radically human life has changed since the advent of electric light. It really has changed everything from one of the tidbits that I found that I really found fascinating is that dinner time went from, 4 or 5, 6 o'clock at night, depending on the light, to 8, 9, 10 o'clock. It just jumped by several hours once we could light it up.
So we could stay awake and do all those other things longer.
Exactly.
Is there a darkest place on Earth, Paul? And if so, what does it take to reach it?
Well, you know, a lot of people I hear, and I'm sure some of your listeners have had this experience of being out in the middle of the ocean as maybe the darkest place that you can get to. There are still a lot of really dark places that would even rank a 1 on the Bortle scale on Earth. But these are, you know, tough places to get to by and large, and most of us can't get to. Even those of us who are writing a book on it, you know, it's tough for us to get out there and do that. And I think that I would really encourage folks to think about the darkness and the lighting in the places that they live. And I really think of my book as a book full of experiences. And I just want people to get out and experience the night.
There are lots of characters in the book that you get a chance to meet, and their descriptions are rich, and we didn't get a chance to get to them. But we obviously got a chance to talk about a lot about the end of night. Paul Bogard, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.